Welcome everyone to Garden Beer for May. Let's begin with a prayer in the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit. Our Father, who art in heaven,
hallowed be thy name.
Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil.
Amen. Saint Mary Philip,
pray for us.
Saint Don Bosco,
pray for us.
Pray for us.
Saint Leo,
pray for us.
I assume there is a Saint Leo.
Yeah, Leo the Great.
Yeah, he just started, he can't.
Leo the Great.
He's only been in the job 3 days.
So this, tonight is a topic very dear to my heart, renewing Catholic education. I've been a school teacher for some years now and worked mainly in Catholic schools and have felt myself and many others I've spoken to seem to feel similarly that there's a sense in which Catholic schools are not firing on all cylinders. Maybe they're not offering the fullness of the Catholic faith or the full richness of the tradition of the Catholic faith at this moment in time and place. So I was really excited a few years ago when I learned that there's a movement of renewal in Catholic education. It comes under a couple of different headings: classical education, liberal arts education. But effectively, it's an attempt to rediscover the rich heritage of Catholic education. And that's something I've become very excited and interested in the last few years. And I wanted to have a Garden Beer talk about this. And I thought there's no better person to explain what this is about, how this renewal has taken shape in some places, both in Australia and significantly in America, than Jonathan Healy. Jonathan is an experienced Catholic school teacher. He's got a couple of master's degrees under his belt. And he's turned himself, I think, into one of the leading proponents of this renewal education movement in Australia over the last few years. He's part of the Australian Classical Education Society, the secretary, I believe, of ACES. We might mention more about that later on. But he's going to give us an overview of what renewing Catholic education could look like.
Good evening, everyone. I'm usually good at a podium, so I hope it's not too distracting having my notes here, and I'll try to go off script if I can. Thanks for inviting me this evening to speak about this really timely issue, the education of our children and future generations of Australians. As you're probably aware, in the media over the last few years, we've been hearing lots of reports about declining educational standards and discipline. There was an organisation recently, the Programme for International Student Assessment, or PISA, who reported on Australian student achievement and found that generally our students achieved from middling to poor in maths, science and reading compared to countries like China, Canada, even New Zealand. We ranked much lower than those countries. And generally, in terms of like NAPAN results over the last few years have been decreasing, as well as kind of just generally graduates from secondary and tertiary education, they're not really producing the good thinking skills that we're used to. So it's quite clear that, we're facing a real problem with education in this country. And there's no clear direction forward. There's no common consensus in terms of where we should be going as a society. And the political parties just seem to offer very kind of cosmetic redresses to what we're dealing with. So I thought tonight's talk, thanks to John's invitation, try a bit of a way forward. And looking at something called Catholic education, that there is something called Catholic education, and that this needs to undergo renewal. And that if this renewal is broad enough, it can have an effect on the educational enterprise in our country. And so I'd like to begin by looking at the Church's vision for education and what the Church has, particularly over the last century, said that a good education should consist of, a good Christian education. And then following that, I'd like to then propose that this is what, as again John alluded to, this is what more broadly is a traditional form of education known as classical or liberal arts education. Now, there's no real one-size-fits-all when it comes to Catholic education. So a lot of the things I'll be talking about are merely suggestions. So if you have any questions or criticisms or alternatives, we can talk about that in the Q&A, that would be great. To briefly introduce myself, as John said, my name is Jonathan Gilley. I've been teaching in both public and Catholic schools, secondary schools, for over 20 years now, with a brief stint overseas and in early childhood. My main educational background is in history, theology, and philosophy. And so I come to teaching, and I come to this topic with both experience in the classroom, but also with a real passion for evangelization and the inculcation of good religious education. And so my interest in classical education really began when I noticed that there wasn't much deep thinking in a religious sense in my students, but also in terms of their critical philosophical rigor. It just wasn't there. A lot of sloppy thinking going on. And I discovered classical education about 6 years ago. And as John said, I've since joined ACES. I'll talk a little bit about that later. And that's really helped me to see a way forward for my students. So I guess before we begin looking at this, we might ask the question, like, is there even such a thing as Catholic education? And if there is, why do we need it? I think it's quite clear that over many centuries, in fact over millennia, church fathers and theologians have theologized and philosophized on what education is, the purpose of education, and how it can bring a young person into a flourishing adult and into the Christian life. Particularly over the last century, a number of important documents have been produced, and I'll be referring to these tonight and just drawing out some key elements about what they say with regards to education. In particular, Brevissimum Educationis from the Second Vatican Council, Pius XI's Divini Ilius Magistri are important, two by Pope St. John Paul II, Sapientia Christiana and Ex Corde Ecclesiae, and then two documents by the Sacred Congregation for Catholic Education, also called the Congregation for Catholic Education, the Catholic School in 1977, and the Catholic School on the Threshold of the Third Millennium, 1997. And if you're particularly interested in this topic, I would highly recommend going to these documents, and they're pretty easy to read, and they really spell out what the Church thinks about education. So I guess if we ask our non-religious friends, they probably might not see a purpose for Catholic education, specifically religious education. In fact, surveys of parents who send their children to Catholic schools in Victoria regularly report that the main reason they send their child to a Catholic school is based on discipline, study scores, and the offering of subjects. Topics or issues like faith growth or growing in the Catholic faith specifically tend to rank rather low. So I guess we could say, well, why not just have a good public school and give it a bit of a religious gloss? But I don't think that works. I think we need Catholic education today for the same reason we have always needed throughout history, and that's to help human beings flourish, both in a secular sense by building good citizens for our society, but also in a religious sense in helping to build up the Church. In fact, a recent article just came out last month in Crisis magazine points to the interesting phenomenon where, in the US, a decline in educational standards was coincidental with a drop in Catholic school enrollments. The author remarks that schools there are closing at a rapid rate, where, unlike Australia, they're not recipients of as much government funding. And in the mid-1960s, there were about 5.5 million Catholic students enrolled in over 7,000 Catholic schools. Today, there are 1.69 million students in under 6,000 Catholic schools, even though the national population has grown by 150 million. The article's author, Raymond Dansereau, writes, and I've quoted it here, he says, quote, "Has Catholic education become an old, stale, outdated model with nothing to offer a modern world in search of sports, electives, iPads, and STEM? The modern atheist says so, but why must we act like we believe them? Why must we seem to accept the inevitable shrink, a new round of closings every few years, with no plan or vision to do anything differently? Very simply, we have lost sight of the mission of Catholic education. And I doubt there's really anyone in Catholic education who would disagree with that statement. And G.K. Chesterton, you might know, noted in his usual witty way, he said that historically, men have always lost their address, their way home, sorry. But he said, what's interesting about modern man is we haven't just lost our way home, we've also lost our address. And I think that's also the case with Catholic education. It's really lost its meaning and purpose. And consequently, anything that's done in the classroom isn't as effective as it should be. And in fact, sometimes it can be antithetical to what it's trying to achieve, a flourishing human being. So I think we should first take the via negativa and ask, all right, what isn't a good education? And that might tell us something about what a good education is. Now, I pulled up this image. I don't know whether you're aware of the news story. Just a few weeks ago, five women, including Katy Perry and Lauren Sanchez, who's Jeff Bezos' fiance, they took a brief space jaunt. And this was seen as something of a pinnacle of human and social achievement. And if you listen to their comments about what they achieved, these astronauts, quote unquote, astronauts, what they achieved for women and what they achieved for future generations of girls who would look up to them. Now, while this might, for some, seem to be a real achievement, I think it really highlights what contemporary education is delivering to our society. In what sense? Well, firstly, I'd say it's very utilitarian. It's very much focused on achieving kind of economic, political, or social growth rather than real human existential growth. It focuses on public over private achievement. It is thoroughly secular and ironically focused simply on earthly living. And lastly, it really lacks any profound philosophical or theological insight. If you listen to the interviews, I mean, I find it fascinating. If you listen to the interviews these women gave about their experience of viewing the Earth from outside our atmosphere, they're completely vacuous, almost like the vacuum of space itself. And I found this quote by Katy Perry. So it's illustrative of the whole thing. So if you like Katy Perry, I'm sorry. She said, quote, "Space is going to finally be glam. Let me tell you something. If I could take up glam with me, I would do that. We are going to put the ass in astronaut." Unquote. My wife is horrified. Instead of saying astronaut. But this is something that was heavily promoted, and it's something they're expecting young children to look up to. And I think, you know, an educated society should be doing a little better than that. Now, I think it's hardly controversial to say that in our society today in Australia, we are increasingly viewing education as a means of skilling up young people for the workforce. Teaching them STEM subjects, so sciences, technologies, engineering, and so forth, so that they can read and write with a modicum of coherence, to achieve high ATARs, to graduate from university, to get a job that will give them good pay so they can have at least something of an enjoyable life. You know, there's a lot of good in that. And oftentimes, subjects that are unrelated with the workplace are often considered a waste of time. I've often had parents who will ask me, what's the point of a young person learning philosophy? Where's that going to get them in life? What job will they get at the end of doing a philosophy degree? And I think this is very indicative of the way our society is going forward. The pursuit of truth, goodness, and beauty is no longer a primary concern for many in education. Just last week, I was fortunate to attend a seminar with Catholic speaker and author Joseph Pierce, who you may know. And he rightly observed that a genuine education is one that at its core asks the question, what is truth? However, today, our schools and those within them, and oftentimes parents as well, they're not asking that question. They're asking the question, what is practical? What works? And this, I think, reflects something also, I believe, Chesterton said, where he commented that if in life we seek the abstract and we seek the transcendental. Basically, we seek those qualities that point to a heavenly reality, like beauty and unity. If we seek those things in life, then all the practical things will naturally follow. But if we seek just for pragmatic things, we really won't achieve anything of worth. Christ knew this when he said, "Seek ye first the kingdom of God, and everything else will follow." Admittedly, if this is how we understand education, as a means of skilling up young people, then we don't really need a Catholic education. Secular education is quite capable of doing that. Of course, you could do all these things, have STEM, the three R's, good exam grades, and add a dose of religious education. You can call this Catholic education. And I'm afraid to say this is what many Catholic schools do today, both primary and secondary. However, this is not what the Church views as Catholic education. Rather, and I'll quote here, this is from the Catholic School on the Threshold of the Third Millennium. Quote, "The social and cultural context of our time is in danger of obscuring the educational value of the Catholic school, in which its fundamental reason for existing and the basis of its genuine apostolate is to be found. Indeed, although it is true to say that in recent years there has been an increased interest and a greater sensitivity on the part of public opinion, international organisations and governments with regards to schooling and education, there has also been a noticeable tendency to reduce education to its purely technical and practical aspects." Unquote. To reduce education to its purely technical and practical aspects. However, if by education we mean something a bit broader than this, if we want our students to be educated physically, to be healthy and part of nature, mentally, to not only know what to think, but how to think, emotionally, to be virtuous, to know how to reach their moral ends, and spiritually, to seek God, then the Church certainly has something to say. There's a nice image of Cardinal John Henry Newman, and he wrote a very famous book, which you may be aware of, called The Idea of the University. It's a compilation of discourses and lectures that he gave, and in it, he really kind of builds... it's called The Idea of the University, but it goes beyond single university. Really, it's looking at what is the heart of education, particularly a Christian education. And when he wrote that, he said that the purpose of education is, quote, "the real cultivation of mind," unquote. It's the idea that, and the image he uses is that the mind is a kind of field, and it needs to be tilled, and it needs to be sowed and watered, and will grow all these wonderful things. But these things grow all together, and it needs time to do so. So what's the cultivation of mind? Newman said that the intellectual and moral virtues should be, quote, "properly trained and formed to have a connected view and grasp of things," unquote. Newman was mining the Catholic tradition of education as not simply filling a willing pupil, or in terms of many teenagers, unwilling pupils, with facts, or ordering the body to, like, servile work, but instead building a positive habit of thought and character. More succinctly, Archbishop J. Michael Miller puts it this way. He says, quote, "The specific purpose of a Catholic education is the formation of boys and girls who will be good citizens of this world, loving God and neighbour, and enriching society with the leaven of the gospel, and will also be citizens of the world to come, thus fulfilling their destiny to become saints." Unquote. So there isn't an authentic form of Catholic education. Specifically, what does the Church say? Here it is. I've got a few dot points from those documents that I think are quite illuminating. Firstly, they say that education should seek to develop a human person in maturity of faith, virtue, and theology for the salvation of their soul. So at heart, an education that is not Christocentric, misses a supreme calling in life. Secondly, education seeks to inculcate the worship of God and a liturgical worship of God and be a vehicle for evangelization. So through right learning, we not only come to know God, but we come to learn our obligation to worship God, that to do so is right and just, our duty and our salvation. Education also seeks to harmonize faith and reason and study scientific truths in the light of Christian revelation. So a proper Christian education will bring all studies under the lordship of Christ. There's no such thing as kind of like a secular subject in a sense. Everything is touched by what God has revealed. Education also seeks to transmit culture and an attitude to life or worldview that is ethical and from the heart of the Catholic Church, integrating both faith and culture. Fifthly, education seeks to give great importance to theological, juridical, and philosophical disciplines. First of all, the humanities and the cultivation of letters. That is, the liberal arts, which I'll talk a little bit about later, have a primary place in a Catholic education. And then lastly, education seeks to use earthly means to grow heavenly ends. That is, quote, preparing man for what he must be and for what he must do here below in order to attain the sublime end for which he was created. There can be no true education which is not wholly directed to man's end, unquote. So the Catholic education is really trying to develop the whole person, not just in terms of their intellectual virtues, the ability to think, the ability to have certain skills, but also in terms of their moral virtues, all towards coming to know Christ and spread the gospel. So if these qualities kind of encapsulate something of the essence of Catholic education, what does it look like in practice? Cardinal Newman recognized it. When he saw a Catholic education, what he really meant was a liberal arts education. And by liberal here, we mean the kind of education that frees the mind to pursue truth, as opposed to just being educated to do a certain type of work. Another more expansive name for this is classical education. And so I'll spend the rest of the talk just talking more specifically about classical education itself. So what is classical education? It's a bit difficult to pin down. There's no one single definition. It's more of a catch-all term. Classical education really describes the way that education has traditionally occurred in the Western tradition, from ancient Greece and Rome through to the Middle Ages up until the early modern period. And to overly generalise, it's the way people like Aristotle, Julius Caesar, Thomas Aquinas, Galileo, Newton, and Thomas Jefferson all learned something like a classical education. Now, there isn't one single pedagogy, but I suppose if you're going to sum it up, I'd say it really consists of four elements. Firstly, it takes Christianity's emphasis on virtuous character development, on faith, and theological outlook. It adds to that the critical spirit of reflection and the public character that you get from ancient Greece and Rome. To that is also added the great works of human achievement, the great books, which we'll also talk about later. And then lastly, and perhaps maybe fundamentally, classical education is just putting into really an institutional format what parents naturally do at home, the way parents raise their children. And these are some important aspects that pretty much most classical educators will agree with, and we'll go through a few of those today. I love this definition by Dr. Christopher Perrin. So he's from the United States. He's something of a classical education revivalist and guru over there. And this is what he says. He says, oh, by the way, I should stop for a second. When we say classical education, we don't mean the classics. So classical education itself, because this is sometimes confusing, doesn't just mean things from ancient Greece and Rome. It's rather the form of education or the pedagogy, but hopefully it will become clearer for those who aren't aware. So this is what Christopher Perrin writes. He says, classical education is a traditional education commenced by the Greeks and Romans, extended during the Christian centuries, grounded in piety, governed by theology. It involved the deep study of the seven liberal arts, and it gave access, therefore, to the great books that have been written. And it was designed to cultivate the humanity of men and women that they might be characterized by wisdom, virtue, and eloquence. One way of understanding classical education a bit more clearly is to contrast it with the form of pedagogy that we have today. By pedagogy, I mean the way teaching and learning happens, usually in an institutional setting, but it also applies to homeschooling. So the form of education we have today in the West is generally known as progressive education. And this was begun during the Enlightenment, particularly by Rousseau, and then developed by John Dewey, you know, famous Dewey Decimal System, and educational theorists in the mid-20th century. And we can kind of compare the way classical education and progressive education differ on three points. They differ on pedagogy, or how teaching and learning happens. They differ on subject matter, what specifically is taught, and they differ on ethos, why teaching happens. And if you're an Aristotelian, we can talk about the differences being on form, and the formal course, and the efficient course, which is the pedagogy, the material course, which is the subject matter, and then the final course, which is the ethos. So what are some differences? Firstly, when we talk about how teaching and learning happens, in progressive education, it comes mostly from a scientific paradigm, where education is developed by experts, usually academics, in universities. Teachers in the classroom are usually, therefore, the mere facilitators of these teaching methods. There's a heavy reliance on textbooks produced by these experts, and the emphasis is really on developing the skills and knowledge in the students. Skills tend to be technical, so students are taught how to do certain things, to follow certain procedures, and the content they learn is more fact-based than knowledge-based. That is to say, they learn to memorise things so that they can regurgitate them rather than gaining knowledge that transforms them as people. Oftentimes my students will say, what's the point of memorising things or learning things when I can just go to Google? And now they have like AI and ChatGPT and all that. But that's all based on this idea that all we need is facts in learning rather than knowledge. Contrarily, classical education comes from a more classical paradigm, where teachers are seen as masters of a craft. So their job essentially is to pass on a tradition they themselves have mastered to the next generation. There is more of a reliance on primary texts rather than textbooks. While skills and knowledge are indeed important, so are other aspects of learning, like ethics, for example, and spirituality. Skills themselves are based on what is called mimesis, which is an imitative form of learning. So instead of being just kind of learning facts, you're actually learning how to copy what the teacher does, to kind of become a little teacher yourself, as well as paideia, the transmission of a cultural way of life. And there's a greater focus on knowledge to transform the self. So that's the difference between the two teaching styles. In terms of subject matter, progressive education has a very prescriptive curriculum. If you've ever seen the Australian curriculum or the Victorian curriculum, it's very specific in terms of what a student has to learn in any particular subject at any year level. And you really can't deviate from those criteria. Subjects tend to be isolated. What you learn in a science classroom is often unrelated to what you learn in English or maths or religion and so forth. Assessment tends to be based on standardised tests like VC exams. Subjects and content are up to date, so things have to be fresh and new. And curricula is often based on whatever the socio-political fad may be. Ethics, when they are taught, are just indirect. Classical education tends to have more flexible curricula. Because the teacher is a master of a craft, they are able to kind of judge what would be good for the student to learn. Subjects tend to be integrated, so you tend to have kind of one subject weaving into another rather than having strict boundaries. Different forms of assessments, and in terms of what you learn, it tends to be material that's stood the test of time rather than what is brand new. And there's a deliberate inculcation of virtue. So schools, classical schools, are deliberately trying to raise virtuous students. In terms of the ethos, and I'll give progressive education its due here, the ethos for progressive education is good, trying to raise good citizens who will improve society economically and so, you know, and in other ways. That's a good end. What they do tend to miss, though, is this idea of the flourishing individual, the individual who's able to grow in many dimensions of what it means to be human. So let's break down classical education a bit. Firstly, I want to start talking about the trivium. The trivium is really the basis of classical education, and it means the three ways. And it's really, it comes from the anthropological awareness that as human beings, we learn over time with increasing difficulty and mastery of something. And this is what the trivium kind of reflects. So at the basis of first stage of the trivium is called the grammar stage. And at the grammar stage, you have kind of basic understanding of a language or a subject. And this is kind of like an infant that's learning how to crawl. Following that, you then move on to the logic stage, sometimes called the dialectical stage. This is when you take basic understanding and you interrogate it. You ask questions, you analyze it, you break it apart, and you gain a kind of deeper understanding of what's going on there. This is like a child beginning to walk for the first time, you know, wobbly feet. And then lastly, you have rhetoric. And rhetoric is when the student has mastered the material. They understand it fully, so much so that they can now create something new. We sometimes get the idea that rhetoric just means a kind of like verbal composition, like oratory. It does involve that. But it also means the ability to take something and just create new forms of learning with it. That can be artistry and so forth. This is like, you know, a young teenager beginning to run, who's very confident on their feet. Now, sometimes, well, the trivium can be understood in two ways. It can be understood as learning through a subject. So, for example, if you were learning Homer's Iliad, you would start with the grammar stage, where you're breaking down the particular language that Homer uses, looking at the characters, looking at the scenery, looking at sequences of events, trying to really grasp what's going on at a very basic level. Then you move on to the logical dialectic stage, where you begin to ask about character motivations, what themes are involved, are there any moral quandaries? And then you move to the rhetoric stage, where you then take what you've got and you might produce something from that, like you might write a reflective essay on it, or you might write a hypothetical scenario that isn't in the Iliad, or you might perform some kind of verbal composition based on it. So the trivium can be understood in that way, but it can also be understood in a way that's staged learning as a child grows up. Different schools, classical schools, will treat it somewhat differently. So the grammar stage is often seen as kindergarten to fourth year level, where much of the learning is based on things like memorization and basic understanding and so on. Then the logic stage is fifth and eighth, and that's what you think about it. You know, teenagers start to question a lot more. They start to want to know why things are happening. And then lastly, you get the rhetoric stage, ninth to 12th, where, you know, as they grow, they want to do new things. They're not just interested in just taking what you've given them. They want to be more kind of creative. So that's another way of approaching the trivium. I might just bypass this at a later time. Now, the trivium comes from ancient Greece and Rome. Medieval Christendom added another four subjects to the trivium called the quadrivium, or four ways. And that's where we get the seven liberal arts, the trivium and the quadrivium. Now, the quadrivium, these are more like typical subjects that we're more used to. They are all numbers-based. And again, like the trivium, they're all kind of increasing in complexity. So I'll just very briefly go through the quadrivium. How we might understand the quadrivium today is it would include mathematics, it would include the physical sciences, it would include the social sciences like sociology, it would include some of the arts like music. These would all be part of what the medievals called the quadrivium. At the basis of the quadrivium is arithmetic, which is helping the student learn what numbers are, how numbers are related to each other, basic arithmetic, how to do your sums. And alongside this, though, you've got this appreciation of God's use of numbers in the world. Like the idea in classical education is you don't just have the dry learning, it's also like, well, what do numbers mean? What do numbers tell us about the way God has structured and created reality? And that helps to develop a sense of wonder and awe. So we've got arithmetic, that's very abstract. Geometry comes next. That begins to kind of concretize the abstract of numbers. We begin to look at, okay, how do numbers work together to form shapes? Like, how many sides does a square have, for example? Or you look at points, or you look at planes, and so on. And this is starting to move numbers into creative reality, the world around us. This then gets even more complex with astronomy. It's taking what you've learned in arithmetic and geometry and applying it to the physical world around you, particularly the heavenly bodies, and seeing how they're interrelated. And then finally, and probably the most sophisticated of all, was music. Now this sounds weird to us, because we think, music, how does this fit into this picture? Music in the Middle Ages wasn't simply instrumental music. Music made by instruments or music made by vocal harmonies and so forth. That was there, that's this last one here, musica instrumentalis. But there were two other forms of music that were seen as actually more important. And the idea behind music, and if any of you who play music and instrument know that numbers are really important to the way music actually works and is ordered. The idea behind music is that God orders the world. And he orders the world so that there's a kind of numerical relationship. So musica instrumentalis does this in terms of just ordinary human production music. Musica humana does this in the nature of social relations, social hierarchies, hierarchies within families, hierarchies within society, hierarchies within the animal kingdom, the plant kingdom, and so forth. But most important was musica universalis, which is looking at how God structures relations between everything in the universe. And so in that sense, it touches a little bit with astronomy, but it goes a bit further. And as you can tell, these kinds of, at the basis of these studies, was trying to develop a sense of God infusing order in the world, the divine logos, actually kind of feeding into the world and structuring it. So, the seven liberal arts form the basis of classical education. But classical education is also interested in developing a full, or at least a mature Christian person. And this is where theology and piety come in. And I'd just like to quote here from Clark and Jane. They have an excellent book, which I highly recommend, called The Liberal Arts Tradition. And this is what they say of the place that theology plays in the curriculum. They say, quote, "Theology unifies the curriculum. It provides a framework for the liberal arts and sciences and the philosophies that unify them. In fact, the very notion of unity itself is derived from theology. All things were created by God, and by him all things continue to exist. In the broadest sense of the term, theology is the telos of the Christian classical curriculum, its end, not merely its culmination." This stress on theology is often absent in most religious schools today. You might have a religious education class But that tends to be a separate class students will go to a bit during the week. But theology itself will not speak to any other subjects in the curriculum. However, part of the classical education, theology is still seen as the queen of the sciences, and so therefore it informs the entire curriculum so that it becomes Christocentric. Now, there's a lot of ways, a lot of intricate ways you can build theology into a curriculum. Some very simple ones are having the Bible at the centre of what's learned, as well as other magisterial texts, but trying to pursue the study of what is called the transcendentals, truth, goodness, and beauty. Those properties that ultimately find their source in God, but we see reflected in everything around us. So, theology, though it does have a very strong theoretical component, is also practical. It's about how we live our lives as good Christians. And this is mostly where piety comes in. So piety is how we order our right relation to ourselves, to others, to the world, and ultimately to God. Aquinas said that, quote, by the gift of piety, man pays worship and duty not only to God, but also to all men on account of their relationship with God. And piety isn't a subject that you learn. It's a kind of culture, an enculturation that you're brought up in. And schools can really work at developing piety in lots of different ways. I've suggested three here. Firstly, regular rituals. Having a regular order of ritual in your daily life, that can be morning prayer, that can be morning mass, that helps kind of set the tone for the student every day so that they can see it's God-centered. Secondly, discipline. So a school with very good discipline will help kind of enculturate piety. And then lastly, rightly ordered affections. That students should see in staff and other students affection, love. And this is something that, you know, that will help them imitate. I've talked a bit about the great books before. The great books are really the main subject matter of a classical education. Something about the great books, they are the works that have continued over the centuries to inform humanity, to help us think deep thoughts, books that have polyvalent interpretations, and books that once you get into them, they're never dull, but get more and more interesting every time you read them. I should say, they're not always books. You know, you can look at, for example, a Raphael Madonna, or a concerto by Bach. You know, that's just as much a great book, a work of great human achievement, as is Plato's Republic or Dante's Divine Comedy. They can be sourced from any nation and generation. So Australia too has its great books. Think of the poetry by Lawson or Patterson or Gwen Harwood. And they're of enormous moral value, and they're of abiding literary and artistic merit. So they're works that have stood the test of time because they're good. There are some examples. You know, needless to say, the Bible is really at the core of these great works, but there are many, many, many examples. We're just going to bypass the teaching methods and that. So when we look at a school and ask, well, what makes a classical school? And my friend Peter had talked about Campion College, which many of you are familiar with. Campion College is the oldest and premier Catholic classical school in Australia. And it kind of embodies a lot of these aspects that make a very good classical school. It's one that has consistent ritual and liturgy. It's one whose environment and architecture speak of Christian truth. So that can be from, you know, paintings of saints to stained glass windows, to open Bibles in corridors, those kinds of things. A school in touch with its tradition, a school that involves parents and the faith community. So it's one where parents are expected to, in a sense, continue the education, and there's no kind of rift between what's learned at school and what's learned at home. It's a school where discipline is rigorous, but an opportunity to grow in virtue, and a school that kind of promotes creation and engages young people in nature, where nature can not only teach earthly truths to young people, but also heavenly ones. I've got an example here, short video. I think the sound will work. This is from St. Thomas More School, which is a classical Catholic school in Austria. And they're doing some really good work at the moment.
St. Thomas More School in Austria, students and teachers are beginning the school day a little differently to most other schools in the country. Every Wednesday morning, the school gathers at 8:30 a.m. to celebrate Mass together. The tranquility of Mass, school kids will be school kids. Walking the corridors, you can't help but notice the joy in the students.
I think this school is very, very good because the teachers are very good to the kids.
It is really good because everyone helps each other. My friends here, my kids here.
The bonding between the kids in the classroom is really nice.
What's your favorite subject?
Sports.
Sports is your favorite subject?
Football,
right. But what's special about this school is that it prides itself in being Catholic. If you met someone who had never been to the school or heard of the school, how would you describe it?
Well, it's Catholic oriented, and you get a good perspective here.
I saw the great relationship between teachers and students, and I really like the community. I am proud to be here.
You don't normally hear students say about their school, "I'm really proud to be here in this school." You really feel proud to be part of the school?
Yes.
What also makes this school unique is that it was founded by parents who wanted to give their children a real Catholic education. Dr. Christian Alten von Geusel was one of the parents who started the school with his wife 9 years ago.
Well, I think the first thing that has to be said is Austria certainly has a very high level of school education, academically speaking. But that was not the only thing we were looking for. We were looking for two other things. We were looking for a profoundly Catholic environment where our children could really grow day and day in faith. And second, a school that goes back to the classical Catholic liberal arts. What the classical liberal education tries to do is it tries to teach young people how to think. That's really where it all boils down to. That's why, for example, rhetoric, grammar, and logic are the first three steps.
That is the basis for a court case, and we are going to also have here a court case.
These senior students have split into groups representing the various roles of a real-life courtroom and are preparing to debate the complex topic of save your siblings, a phenomenon of bioethics.
It can happen that the parents only begin to look at the life of the sibling.
And like in any real courtroom, the debate can get a little heated.
The girl in the movie, she's the person.
I'm sorry, we can't possibly have one.
It's a private fee-paying school, with the fee for each child being around $4,500 per year. 60% of the school's annual budget is then fundraised. It is completely independent of state funding.
3 years ago.
The first year there were 12 teachers, more than the amount of students. Annie Sellner and Alexandra Teufel are two of the teachers.
I started when the school started, actually. It was really an adventure for me. And I was able to grow also with the school.
As a Catholic, you can express and focus on Catholic teachings without restrictions.
Today, there are 65 students enrolled, and it is growing year by year.
Beauty is an avenue to truth.
And the principal Christian says that an important part of the school is also making sure it is beautiful, inside and out.
every window the students look from, they have a beautiful view on another beautiful building or on nature. If we create beauty around us, it puts our mind at rest.
Things that we learn here, we really
also, you can like really reflect on the faith in the lesson. So this is, I think, definitely something that's not the same in other schools.
What we as Catholics can do is we can bring in a rich tradition, but above all, we can bring in the most important question. What did God, the Creator, intend with this? We are allowed to ask that question. And it broadens the perspective enormously.
Thanks, John. I didn't tie in too much. Okay, so I'll just finish with looking at just a couple of, I guess, stats that was helpful to see how these classical schools are doing. The kind of revival in classical education began in the 1970s, 1980s, principally in the US, but it's since spread that, so that there, so the United States and Australia and Europe and Australia is also becoming part of this growth. The Association of Christian Classical Schools, the ACCS, they commissioned a study called Good Soil. You can find it on the internet, where they looked at life outcomes from over 2,000 of their students over a broad period of time, and they compared them with like students who go to different schools. That graph might not be much to you, so hopefully you can kind of see this one. So the bold red at the top, they're the ACCS schools, of which there are hundreds. I'll show you a map in a second. And they rated how their students compared to other students from homeschools, evangelical schools, Catholic schools, and so on college and career, outlook on life, Christian practices, Christian life, traditional conservative, independent thinkers, and influences. And the students who graduate from their schools have easily achieved higher results than practically all the other students. Even on SAT scores, so the standardized tests for university entrance, graduates from their schools rank higher than students from independent and private schools. So in terms of the ACCS, you can find them at classicalchristian.org. This is an association of mainline Protestant and evangelical schools in the United States. So classical schools will join this association. You're not obliged to, so there are lots of other classical schools that are just independent of this, but this is where they've located, and you can see that there's a considerable number. And if you go to their website, you know, you can go to each little tab there, and you can go to the school's website and find more about each school. There's also a Catholic Association, the ICLE, and they too are represented by quite a number of schools, and this is growing. In Australia, we do have some schools. We've already mentioned Campion College. But there are some secondary schools and primary schools that have been established or that are soon to be established. And Queensland Toowoomba Christian College is transitioning to more of a classical school. St. Philomena School, which has been established for some time. St. John of Kronstadt, which is an Orthodox classical school that just opened last year. John Henry Newman is a Catholic classical school that is opening next year. In New South Wales, there's Hartford College, Augustine Academy, and Campion, and there's one, St. Benedict in South Australia is opening soon, and WA has a couple of smaller classical tutor schools. In Victoria, unfortunately, we are kind of absent that. I guess Harkaway is the closest we have. But hopefully, fingers crossed, things are happening soon. In terms of associations, John mentioned before the Australian Classical Education Society, and we were established a couple of years ago to kind of help bring together the kind of independent streams of classical education in Australia. We also try to provide resources, professional development, and the kinds of things that parents and teachers need for classical education. And there are some online kind of academic packages you can get, and also some booksellers like Logos Australia is very good. I've just got some websites, and I'll bypass this, and some useful texts. If anyone would like a copy of these slides, just let me know. I'm happy to send to you a copy. There are some great books out there. If you're really interested in classical education, one way to really get started is to just get a book on classical education and read it. These are all excellent. I would highly recommend The Liberal Arts Tradition by Ravi Jain and Kevin Clark. However, Introduction to Classical Education by Christopher Perrin is probably pretty easy, pretty accessible. Dorothy L. Sayers, the great Anglican writer of the early 20th century, she wrote this essay, The Lost Tools of Learning. You can find it online for free. She mostly talks about the trivium. She has a very interesting take on the trivium, but it's quite a good read. So I guess I'll stop there. Thank you very much.
Any questions?
I feel like the biggest...
I don't think that one's working.
I feel like the biggest hurdle is training the teachers, and I'm a teacher myself and went to Melbourne Uni, but the teacher training is geared towards training for the progressive education, and so there's going to be a big disparity between the public schools who don't have this kind of education and the classical. Do you find that in the Catholic universities they are training teachers to and equipping them with the classical education so that they can go out and teach those subjects?
Yeah, great question. I also was trained at Melbourne Uni. And my understanding is that the teacher training at institutions like ACU are very similar. So they're teaching in the traditional kind of progressive way of learning. And this is one of the issues with classical education, is teachers need two forms of learning. Firstly, they need to be taught out of what they've learned at teaching college, and they need to be taught into this kind of teaching. So it's difficult. I mean, I think at the moment the best options we have are to kind of tap into resources in the United States. There are a lot of online teaching universities like Classical U. Let's go back a bit. Classical U. They have lots of subjects online where you can just go through kind of training online. In terms of accreditation for Australia, it doesn't really apply, although I do know the Melbourne Archdiocese of Catholic Schools, they will consider some of these as forms of accreditation for teaching. Secular school bodies, government probably won't. Good question.
With these students that are going to these classical schools, what's the main motivation to do well in this type of school? You know, a lot of their peers and whatever are probably just going to ordinary schools.
I can only speak from the few that I know. So I do know some who have graduated from Campion College. There tends to be a few common feat characteristics. One, that they tend to be very devout. So they see that they're learning as part of their kind of faith commitment. Secondly, they tend to have a great love of literature. And so they see that going to these kinds of schools kind of help develop that love and the growth of literature. They tend to also like history and philosophy, that helps. So they tend to be elements. I think they often see that going to this kind of school is going to grow them as a person, and so they see it as a good, worthy sacrifice or commitment. John, do you want to add to that?
Yeah, I might add one thing. I think one of the great virtues of classical liberal arts education is that people that go through it come out very versatile. Mm. So you hear a lot from politicians and school leaders in Australia that they want their education to prepare students for the jobs of tomorrow. So they think, okay, what are the... That means computer programming, or that means mathematics or something like that. So they tend to think that's what we need to focus on. But what tends to happen is, if you're trying to prepare for the jobs of tomorrow today, it's going to be out of date in 5 years' time. You're on a hiding to nothing trying to predict what jobs are going to be there in 5, 10 years. So classical education says, let's develop a really intelligent, wise, versatile person who can handle whatever situation they're going to end up in. And with Campion College, I think a lot of the graduates that have come out of Campion have gone into fields like teaching, medicine, law, and I heard recently they've got about 10 of their graduates working at Sky News in various forms of journalism and media. So it's a very versatile education that can take you in a lot of different directions.
And some of the IT experts in Silicon Valley, they actually set up their own classical schools there where they will enrol their children. They would enrol their children there because basically what they've said is, they also don't give them access to IT while they're there. And they say anything a young person needs to learn how to use computers, they can probably learn that in about 4 or 5 months. But true education, learning how to think, that takes much longer. And so that needs to be at the bedrock of learning. And, you know, places like classical schools do help do that. Yes, sir?
Just want to ask, I'm not sure I missed something. Is there a strong denominational context to use? Is it a Catholic thing generally or no?
No, it's a bit of a mixed bag, really. I mean, I wouldn't even say it's a Christian thing, although primarily it is. There are classical schools in countries like India that come from a Hindu perspective. There are Muslim classical schools that are opening. There are Jewish classical schools more recently that have opened. But it is predominantly Christian. The revival actually began among evangelical Christians. So that's quite big in the United States, but the Catholics have really picked up on it. So it's primarily Christian, but interdenominational.
How would it help educating the sciences? I'm from a scientific background, physics and maths specifically, a bit of astronomy. How would it help? Would it be a greater benefit doing it in a classical way rather than the progressive way?
What do you mean by benefit?
In terms of the overall education, the way in which it's educated, would you get a better... Would you learn it in a? Would you get a better understanding if taught in a classical way?
Well, what classical education does is tends to put the sciences, the physical sciences, in their context. So, as you're learning physics, you'll learn not just simply the mathematics of physics and so on, but you'll learn physics in relation to God's creation, physics in relation to philosophy and theology, physics in relation to literature, in the sense of like being able to express oneself in a way that is beautiful rather than simply utilitarian.
Analytical.
Yeah. Mm. So I think the best way to say is that it puts those subjects, like any other subject, in a broader context where you can see interrelationships between things. Mm. And that's to kind of help you be more broad-minded rather than narrow-minded. As a student. This is one of the things that I find frustrating. So I teach senior history, and you rarely find a student who studies sciences do history, because they have been trained to think in a particular way, scientific method in that way, and so that's all they can do. They can't, if they sat in a history class, they wouldn't be able to think in the way history students think. And I would say vice versa, that the way we're teaching our students, you know, if you take a student from history class, they wouldn't have a clue about physics.
Actually, it's funny that you bring that up, because while I was trained scientifically, history is one of my hobbies and passions, and I've probably taught myself more history just from learning myself, reading books, and probably because I had a mindset to understand timelines and history that I could do that. But all that has been through my own studies, not through any formal education. The scientific part was the formal, but the history I've just learnt myself.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's been in a sort of in my own classical way, but I've just been there.
But see, you're evidencing there the precise reason behind classical education. As human beings, we want to know more. we want to learn all these facets of what it means to fulfill us as human beings. And I bet the more history you learn, the better you are at your physics, the better you are at your science.
Yeah.
Sorry,
John. Yeah, I was just going to add something to that. So the question was something like, you know, how would a classical education do science and maths differently to, you know, mainstream sort of normal education?
Yeah.
I think, as well as, like Jonathan was saying, adding the context around it, connecting it to other disciplines, I think another important difference would be, you know, a lot of the time, the way we teach science in our schools today, the way science is kind of presented in society generally, it leads to a kind of arrogance. It leads people take away from studying science. Oh, we've figured everything out. We know how the universe works.
Yeah.
The universe is this machine, and we've figured out all the rules and how it operates.
Science by consensus.
I guess we don't need God anymore. So they sort of come out of it kind of arrogant. Whereas I think a classical approach to science would say, look at this magnificent world God has created, and look at the order that we can discover within it. And so a classical approach to science, you come away humbled by creation and by nature and by the beauty of God's creation. So it's you're bringing a very different attitude to the study of science, which I think actually makes you a better scientist.
When I was studying physics, one of the things, I studied at Monash, and so it was purely analytical, scientific, but the one thing was, as I was learning like things like physical constants and the way the universe worked, you can't help but feel that there was a greater power, just the way everything, all the universal constants are just right for life to have evolved and things like that. So you do come away actually thinking, yeah, it's not just by coincidence, it's not just random.
Done right, science should lead people to God because it reveals, you know, an impossibly complex and ordered creation that couldn't be random, the result of mere chance. But yet somehow, that's exactly, that kind of atheistic view is exactly what most people read into science the way we do it. So I think that greater context is really necessary and important.
And I think just in terms of the thematic way of learning, that's been one of the big disruptions between the early modern period and our modern period, is that we've lost the sense of order. You know, having kind of like evacuated God from the classroom and the halls of higher learning, there isn't a sense of order in the world in which we live. Whereas order was a primary way, a primary lens through which the medievals saw the world in lots of ways. Right. Any other questions? Yes.
Have you come across with classical education any issues like people trying to get jobs in certain fields, and because they're from a classical education rather progressive, it's difficult for them to get a job in that field, like governments or something like that? Is that an issue, or is that sort of...
Not that I'm aware of. The movement's very young in Australia, and so, as John was saying, we've got graduates from Campion College. They usually have no problems finding employment. They've got a very broad and very, very good education there. But because it's so young in Australia, it's hard to see the impact yet. What I will say is that there certainly is resistance to classical education. Because it's seen for what it is. It is traditional. It's seen as conservative and Christian, and so it's seen as kind of pushing against those kind of progressive social elements that the government tries to instill in education. So there is certainly resistance to it. Yeah.
So there's no problems with like the government's trying to limit the spread of or the expansion of classic schools that we've. Not like in America or places like that?
It hasn't really been put to the test yet. It hasn't really been. Maybe within the next couple of decades it will be, but as yet, not as much yet because it's still young. In America, it's not the case. America is a far more kind of independent spirit to the way schools function there, and the government interferes much less. So things have been much better there. Yeah.
Thank you.
Sorry.
For classical education to work, I feel the teachers have to be the masters of craft, but I feel that one of the biggest challenges is that the teachers have to have been exposed to those primary texts and high-quality literature, but if they haven't read those and it takes a lot of effort to do that, how quickly are we able to have classical education in the classrooms?
Yeah, very good question.
Those features?
That's a very good question. We can't do it quickly. We can't do it quickly. I think if we began from the junior years, which is ideally where you should begin, then it's a lot easier because obviously the texts you're dealing with are a lot simpler, and teachers can master that a lot now. But you know, when we're talking about more sophisticated works, you need to really be dealing with teachers that love the material they're covering and that are deeply learned in the tradition. And that takes time, and it takes a certain kind of teacher. So not every teacher is going to be suited to a classical school. And by the way, talking about classical education, I think it's a wonderful way of going forward. But don't think that this is the only way forward. You know, at the moment we have things like, you know, we've got Montessori schools, we have Steiner schools, and they're all doing excellent things. In many ways, paralleling a lot of what's done in classical education. So this is just one avenue forward. And I think it's better than what we have at the moment, but there will always be the progressive school, at least in, you know, in the near future. So, yeah. Yes, sir.
I just want to say, just cement something that John just said about evolution being random. It's Charles Darwin's own philosophy, a belief that evolution, that any change to the structure of any one cell in relation to any one species, and that started with the amoeba, I assume, the first living creature, was that it was a random change. Now, when you contemplate a world where the human eye does not work unless it's 100% developed, you say a human eye that is 99.9999% developed, any change is random, so it doesn't. One that naturally leads to the completion of the working human eye. It's in my mind a preposterous proposition that evolution is in fact random, and the only other alternative is that there's some organisation around that. Now, might have been the Martians, or otherwise not. Like, you know, it's just put that as a proposition that hasn't not really generally put that way. But if you think about that, it allows you. You know, even in a scientific sense, to say, well, maybe evolution is not a thorough explanation.
And absolutely, and what you're saying about evolution being random or blind evolution—that's a philosophical conception. It's not anything you actually get out of the science itself. Like doing, you know, scientific experiments in a laboratory won't tell you whether anything's guided or there's kind of some kind of ultimate principle behind it. And I think that's another difference that we have where we've lost that sense of God ordering the world. I've bypassed this before. This is a sample of a biology unit I pulled out from Ambrose School, which is a classical school in Idaho, in the US. And this is specifically on evolution. And part of what they're teaching is, like, these are all to do with theology, understanding God's creation and his intelligent design. Articulate how studying evolution confirms the presence of a creator. Become better stewards of the world around them, articulate, and so on. So this is all involved in a science class, which you will not get today. You go to a science class, you won't hear anything about, even in a Catholic school, you will not hear things about God being the creator and ordering things. And so this is another difference. John?
I think you're probably done.
Okay,
cool. Thanks, Sarah. Thanks, Evan. Thanks so much.
Thanks so much, Jonathan. Can we give Jonathan a round of applause? So, Jonathan, that was terrific. Thank you. I hope everyone was inspired and excited, as I was by that. I thought, I think classical liberal arts education sounds amazing. Western civilization is, you know, kind of wobbling a little bit at the moment. The last few years, we're seeing a lot of decline in a lot of Western countries, politically, economically, things seem a little bit unstable. And I think, personally, I think a lot of that can be traced to a decline in our education system. And for me, classical liberal arts education represents, you know, in some sense, the only way to renew Western civilization without without returning to the roots of what made Western civilization great, it's inevitably going to decline further and further. So when I see this, I think it's what we need, both as a society, as a civilization, as a nation in Australia. I think it's what our children need, and it's what I'd love for my kids, for my children, and for my students as a teacher as well. So thanks for laying it out so beautifully, Jonathan, and sharing this really important renewal that's happening with us. I'd love to share with you one aspect of that renewal. I think Jonathan kind of alluded to this. I'm myself part of a group of teachers and students that are trying to start the first classical liberal arts school in Victoria. There's been a couple of attempts to start one that founded. I think maybe the government didn't look too positively towards it, but undeterred, there's a group of us that are trying again to create a new classical liberal arts school in the Catholic tradition. So there's some flyers floating around. I think there's some at the table at the back. If you're interested in that, come and talk to me. I'd love to tell you more about it. In the meantime, we've got the next Golden Year coming up in a couple of weeks. Signs of Hope and a New Pope. It was originally going to be Father Dean Matheson just talking about some of the great signs of hope and growth in the church. Where's the church growing and where are things going strong? Because a lot of people, rightly point out there's a lot of decline or there's, sad stories around. But there's also places and organisations within the church, groups within the church that are growing like gangbusters. It's very exciting. So I was originally just going to focus on that, but then Pope Francis passed away, sadly, and then a few days ago we got a new Pope. And so I thought it was a good way to join what would be, I'm sure a lot of people were interested in trying to learn more and understand a new Pope, hopefully over the 14th, and that could also coincide with this topic of signs of hope within the Church. We've also got the Archbishop's Dinner. So this is the annual fundraising event that the Knights of the Southern Cross put on. It's always a fantastic night. It's at a new venue this year, is that right?
No, it's still Moonee Valley. This is the last year of Moonee Valley.
To get to the annual fundraising dinner at Moonee Valley.
Will be in a different location next year.
But at that venue is what I'm saying.
Yes.
No, it won't be at Moonee Valley the year after.
It'll be somewhere else.
Moonee Valley's been...
Speaker's Andy Mullins. He's an alumni of God and Beer. He's given talks at God and Beer. He's a wonderful speaker, really warm and well-educated man.
We had the official launch at Corpus Christi College Seminary this past Wednesday, so we've officially launched the dinner. We will have brochures probably by the next God and Beer. We should have brochures available. Otherwise, you can see me if you're interested. It'll be up on the Melbourne Archdiocesan website at some point under events. So
this is probably the premier event that happens in the Catholic Church in Melbourne every year. Big crowd, great atmosphere, and a great way to support our future priests in the seminary. Thank you, our sponsor, Catholic Development Fund. They've got this deal here. You can read the details there. Term investment accounts. I heard someone, I'm not a financial person, but I did hear someone say the other day that term investment accounts is actually the best place to put your money at the moment.
We have Bernard Doherty over there if anyone wants to see Bernard.
Thanks, Bernard. And is there anything else? Make sure you're following God and Beer on social media. Thanks to Andrew for all the great work he does. You'll be able to find the video and photos on our Facebook page and YouTube account very soon.
Podcast.
Thanks, everyone. See ya.
Thanks, man.